efficient the 11,000 state companies that are under the government's control. I mean, Libya is a bizarre country. Even the barber shops and everything was nationalized. So everything is under state control. So his thing was to make those efficient. So he brings in Ernst & Young and the Oxford Group and people like that to come and make things efficient. So Jibril is the political guy. Second person sent overseas to try to smooth international feathers was Gaddafi's very close ally from 1969. And his name is Khusa Musa. Important character, is sent abroad. In fact, he will negotiate with the British over Lockerbie, will negotiate with the Americans, with the Maltese and others. Sophisticated guy. Now, Jibril joins the rebellion. Hiftar comes flown in to lead the military troops. There's still popular democracy going on underneath. People are still thinking that they're fighting a revolution. But it's slowly being usurped by this section. And I'm going to come to Khusa Musa in a second. As this is happening, the new leadership in Benghazi says, we need air support. Now, this is not the same leadership as the young people in Tahrir Square. This is not even a Google executive. The actual people who say, now, we need air support, one, a CIA, maybe, I don't know, maybe. He lived in Vienna, 7 miles from Langley, whatever it is. He is in charge, says, we need air support. Jibril in Paris says, we need air support. And, of course, Ghosh Kavya, Bernard Henry Levy in Benghazi from a revolutionary bunker is calling his friend Sarkozy saying, you cannot make the mistake people made in Rwanda. I'd like you to think, who could the West have bombed to have stopped the genocide in Rwanda? People don't ask that question. Certainly the genocide should not have occurred. But who did you want to bomb when the Kagame brought the people across the border? Where would you have bombed? Why don't we have that discussion someday? You know, how would aerial bombardment have stopped that genocide happening? Separate issue, but anyway. But that's what Bernard Henry Levy said to Sarkozy. And that is exactly what Samantha Power, Susan Rice, and others said. A State Department official said the following, very, this could, I'll give you a few quotes. Soon I'll end, okay?
No,
I'll end soon. Please, God. First, I'm going too fast now, I forgot what I'm doing. No, I'll tell you, this is a very good quote. Samantha Power, as you know, has always wanted to revive the idea of humanitarian intervention. And their feeling was that Bush ruined it. That by going into an unnecessary war in Iraq, the concept of humanitarian intervention was compromised. And there was a need to revive it. So, Massimo Calabrese, who writes for Time magazine, reported that a senior official told him that there was an effort to shoehorn the Libyan events into an imminent genocide model. Okay, they had to make a case that the genocide was imminent. All right, this was important to them. And then he said that by late February, people like Samantha Power, Jeremy Weinstein, both of the National Security Council, Susan Rice, U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Hillary Clinton, and others were, the quote is, laying the predicate for an intervention. Laying the predicate, lovely line, for the intervention. Okay, apparently at that time Robert Gates, pretty sensible guy, said this is a terrible idea. Because we are going to get embroiled in a civil war we don't understand. There's no end game, there are no interests that are available on the surface. All right. Now, let's put these two things together, Libya and Bahrain. But to get there, we need to go through one more UN resolution. On March 26th, the United Nations will sit again, the Security Council. This time, a very serious debate takes place about whether the United Nations needs to go beyond Resolution 1970. Resolution 1970 said no arms sales to Libya. Now the issue was, they want a no-fly zone. They being the rebels in Benghazi. I've already told you who the rebels are. They are not quite the same as they were on February 26th, when Resolution 1970 was pushed forward. This is a different time now. By the time we get from February 26th to March 19th, the game has changed a little bit. So March 19th, the discussion opens. In the Security Council, there's a characteristic difference available. Three countries which since 2003 have been operating together as a bloc India, Brazil, and South Africa, so-called IBSA bloc. They've had meetings since the Brasilia meeting of 2003. The IBSA bloc coordinates and says, this is a terrible idea. We cannot allow, just as Samantha Power and others wanted to revive humanitarian intervention, the IBSA people wanted to say, we cannot allow humanitarian intervention to be revived. And a contradiction emerges in the Security Council, and Germany goes with the IBSA countries initially. Russia and China say we do not favor intervention. In the middle of this debate, an interesting development takes place. The Arab League comes in and says, you must intervene. Otherwise, genocide is imminent. Now, what is the Arab League? 20-odd countries. The quorum was barely met. When the Arab League met, there was something like 11 countries at the table, and a majority was produced in that meeting. The GCC countries voted for intervention, Saudi Arabia shoehorning everybody else. But they still had just a simple majority in the Arab League. When the Arab League said that, the Chinese and Russians says we will abstain from the vote. In other words, we will not veto it. And joining them in abstaining was India, Brazil, and Germany. Obama personally called Jacob Zuma of South Africa, personally called him and talked to him on the phone and said, you have to vote with us on this. And Zuma then voted for Resolution 1973. Resolution 1973, to my mind, is a very dangerous resolution for at least three reasons. Reason number one is it is claiming to uphold R2P, responsibility to protect. But I think it muddies responsibility to protect for the second reason. It claims to do it, but it doesn't clarify in practice what responsibility to protect means, because for the second reason, it says the UN Security Council has the responsibility to protect civilians. But how do you tell who is a civilian, especially in the context of a civilian uprising against a regime? Are you defending civilians, or are you going to support the rebellion? That clarity was not addressed. Therefore, this second problem actually confuses responsibility to protect. If this was indeed about responsibility to protect, you would really need to know whether you understand clearly who is a civilian. And that was not clarified. It was brought up in the debate that we are walking down a dangerous slope. Those are the two basic problems with R2P. R2P is an interesting idea, but it's always vague. It's an idea that actually is designed to make us feel better than it's something that we can clearly understand how to implement. What does it mean to have the responsibility to protect civilians somewhere else? What is a civilian? Any rebellion then should be protected? If we go out, 10 of us with guns, and walk down the road, and the police come at us, SWAT teams, helicopters like in Philadelphia, you know, where they bombed the Honor Move headquarters, and things like that, or what is it, Ruby Ridge? Should the UN protect them? I mean, they're just sitting there with guns in their house, and the federal agents swarm. What is responsibility to protect? It's a very unclear doctrine. It's not a clear, I'm not surprised, when Nicholas Kristof champions it like that, has he thought it through? I don't think so. He doesn't think too many things through. He goes for slogans. He's a little better than his friend Thomas Friedman, but not much better. It's a very unclear, scary doctrine to me. Third thing is more frightening. Susan Rice insisted in the middle of the debate that a phrase be added. And let me just read the phrase, because this is important. So the resolution of March 19th says that the United Nations Security Council must take all necessary measures, comma, then the United States added this clause, this thing. Very important. Listen to this. The United Nations must take all necessary measures, comma, notwithstanding paragraph 9 of 1970, comma, to protect civilians and civilian populated areas. That little phrase is very important. And it might sound nothing to you, but let me explain it. Comma, notwithstanding paragraph 9 of 1970, comma. Paragraph 9 of 1970 says arms embargo against Libya. Take all necessary measures, comma, notwithstanding paragraph 9 of 1970. What does notwithstanding mean? That means take all necessary measures regardless of paragraph 9 of 1970. In other words, we are setting it up to arm the rebellions. And this the UN Security Council had some problem with, but Rice put that in. and it was passed. That's March 19th. In other words, March 19th says no fly zone. Fine. A list of names of Libyan leaders whose assets had to be sealed. Come back to that in a minute. So, no fly zone. Fine. List of names of people. And thirdly, arms may be given in some future time. It was not a responsibility to protect resolution. This was a resolution in support of the rebellion. Clearly. You'd have to be really... I mean, you don't need to take high-level literary criticism to come to this. This is a fairly straightforward thing for me. This was on 19th of March 2011, and the French bombs bomb within hours. Of course, you know they bomb everywhere, in Tripoli, etc. Never mind. They're bombing rebels also, 13 dead last night. Never mind. The important thing is this. The United States will move in two kinds of aircraft. AC-130 and A-10 Thunderbolt 2. I'm not a gun person. I had to read up on these things. These, when I read up, are very interesting kinds of vehicles. These are not to create a no-fly zone. These are boots in the air. They hover in the air and they use Bofa cannon and they fire at ground troops. So, in a sense, we are already involved in the ground thing. And right now the rebels are saying, why have you withdrawn the AC-130? They said this yesterday. Bring them back. When they said American planes have left and the French are there, we want the American planes back. What they want is these airships. Because they will be like UFOs, hovering in the sky, firing at Gaddafi's troops. So that was 1970, the resolution. The deal cut that has been reported by the London Telegraph, other papers, why the GCC was so enthusiastic in the Arab League, why Saudi Arabia led the troops in the Arab League, it is suggested by several of these reports, including by Pepe Escobar, who writes for Asia Times from Brazil. Pepe is a very good journalist. He talked to several Brazilian diplomats who confirmed some of this. And what the story is that the GCC said, we will back this to the hilt in the Arab League, but we must be allowed to crush Manama. That we are going to go in the next day and we're going to take care. And you will see the next day Saudi troops will cross the causeway under GCC flag and they will crush the rebellion in Bahrain. And under cover of the bombings in Libya, it was in the papers, Bahrain crushed, but who followed that crushing? So that's one thing I want you to consider. Then as the rebels move up the Mediterranean road towards Tripoli, a crucial member of Gaddafi's inner circle defects. Kusa Musa will go to London. Now, resolution 1973, I told you, has a list of names of people whose assets were seized. Mm-hmm. Everybody there is there, including Shokri Ghanem, who's head of the oil corporation. Not directly involved in the military decisions. He is there. But Kusa Musa was not there. Why was he not on that list? Just a few days later, he will defect to Britain. He will fly in a Libyan plane and land in a British military airport. I don't know. I find this bizarre. You know, I'm not suggesting anything. I just don't know. I was talking to a journalist on NPR. I said to him, why don't you ask the government this story? Why was his name not on the list? Just a simple question. Yes, yes, I'll ask. Forget it. Today I was on Al Hurra, the propaganda channel of the United States government that broadcasts in the Middle East and in Europe. And I asked them this question. They said, thank you very much for your insight. Close down. Okay, fine. Okay, so, last, final thought. I've given you a sense of why I think we have intervened. I think that it's fair enough. Nobody wants people to unjustly suffer. I understand that. I understand why, you know, people, I think, lost their bearings with Libya. Reporting is terrible. There is no understanding of that part of the world. I mean, I'm talking about Libya. Understanding of other places, it's like a forgotten place, it's a laughing stock. The idea of the big dictator is so dramatized, you know, that he is a brutal guy. There's no sense that, you know, who is below, who are the other players, what kind of base of support they have. The military is now in the middle of a stalemate. American congressman has arrived in Tripoli yesterday and he said to Gaddafi, we will make you an offer, hope you won't refuse it. We want to make you the honorary chairperson of the African Union. Imagine. and we would like to have Saif al-Islam Gaddafi remain and run for elections. Imagine. I mean, imagine. This is the deal-making that may start now. Why? Because it's a military stalemate. It's a military stalemate because it was always going to be a military stalemate, unless the United States and French went full throttle, which they were not going to do. So that's where we are. So now we can you can ask me some questions. Okay. Hey, you can now. That timing. You can come and ask me a question. That would be good. Yes, please. Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate your analysis. I heard you on Mars now in that debate. But I was so glued to Benghazi late at night, BBC, right from Benghazi. And it, my memory is that when Gaddafi put down the Western protesters, there was no ability to understand how many people were being killed. So that's where the rumors of the massacre came. And then he made those statements that people in Benghazi, there was going to be no mercy. So that sort of fueled the fire. But that's not my question. The question is, there's a lot more confusion over the American motive here, particularly because Gates, who in my mind represents the Bush kind of cabal and those oil interests and whatever, was against this, which means that they had made friends with Gaddafi and he didn't want it ruffled, perhaps, to me. That the only other reason then is a humanitarian, or at least, as you say, to revive humanitarian intervention. Why did they go in? Was it that the reason? Or, as most lefties are saying, it's to get the oil, it's to get the... Well, why wasn't Gates and right-wing Republicans in favor if it's for the oil? You understand?
Okay, so the first thing I would say is I wouldn't say Robert Gates is reducible to the oil interests, because Gates is also a pragmatic head of a bureaucracy. And the bureaucracy he heads is the U.S. military, which is incapable currently of fulfilling its current obligations, let alone new obligations. I mean, it may cost up to several million dollars just to conduct a no-fly zone. And they're going to screw the country on Friday by closing the government down. I think he's a pragmatic head of a bureaucracy. I think that's how he was speaking from that point of view. That unless we are actually able to wind down Afghanistan, wind down Iraq, you can't enter Syria, you can't enter Libya, so that's one piece of it. I actually don't think this is directly related to American oil interests. There may be some French interests there. There was a Gaddafi, these things always come up. Why is it that before Saddam Hussein was invaded, he went to the OPEC ministry meeting and said, we need to shift our holdings from dollars to euros? Mm-hmm. Remember, he did that in the summer before, not summer, it was the summer of 2002. Oh, why, Gaddafi just a few months ago said that we're going to change our revenue sharing agreement. And most of the oil companies in Libya are European, many of them. Europe is the bulk buyer of Libyan oil. So there are all these things that are there, but it cannot be reduced to that because events move too quickly. Imagine they are sitting in the White House. There are long-term plans, which is why the Project for a New American Century brought out a statement saying, invade Libya. I don't know if you saw that. PNAC, they came out. Wolfowitz, invade Libya. That statement could have been Xeroxed from the invade Iraq, invade everybody statement. So there are these long-term ideologues, but there are also events that are moving too fast. But my feeling is the Libyan story is a combination, if you just take elite policy, it's a combination on the one side of, yes, sections in the White House that were looking to rehabilitate interventionism. That's definitely on the table. That's one piece. But another piece, as I suggested, is coming from here. The Saudi tail is wagging the American dog a lot. Gates went to Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis essentially read the act to him, and the New York Times published it like that. Saudi Arabia said, this, and this. Oh, sorry. This, and this. So there is something there that the Saudis were very scared. Abdullah called Al-Khalifa to come and meet him in Riyadh. He summoned another emir. And tail between the legs, Bahraini, he came and said, your superb highness, what can I do for you? And he said, go back and smash them. So I think that's very much a piece of it. It's not all about, the other things that we think about. Because events did move so quickly. This really proves the domino theory, in a way. there is a wave that swept. Local grievances got caught up in a wave. And I think the Saudis looking at that said, oh my God, if Bahrain falls, we are going to have a problem here. Yeah?
The question, with all the billions that are in those private bank accounts, billions, is there a way for the alliance to get a hold of it and just buy off the supporters, the top supporters of Gaddafi, and offer them homes in England, France, America, or wherever? Because there are billions and billions.
Correct, and those houses, there's that house in London with a swimming pool, heated beautiful. I looked at those pictures of Saif al-Gaddafi's house, al-Islam's house. I think there are commitments and there are commitments. The other day, his daughter was on television, Libyan state television, talking about how she only watches Libyan state television, how great her dad is, and there are commitments and there are commitments. It's not always easy to buy people off. People also have a certain world view. There's a view. There was a picture. Oh, I didn't bring it. New York Times had a picture of some rebels with a French flag on top of a tank. Imagine if you're seeing that in Tripoli. This is Italian colonialism. So, I would not say. Plus, I'm not an international finance expert. I don't know how easy it is to access bank accounts. You can freeze them. I don't know if you can liquidate them that easily. So, I'm not sure that that's as easy as it seems. Remember, after Mobutu died, it was found that his bank account in Switzerland was equivalent to the debt of the DRC. 5 billion? Something like that? But it could not be transferred to the DRC. There's some private property problems. In other words, our greatest prejudice in life is private property. So I don't know if you can liquidate it that easily. Yeah.
So in your description of the talk before the talk,
yeah,
you had said that why the U.S. was in Libya was to quash the spring, the Arab Spring, as you call it. But in tonight's talk, it sounds like the Americans just reacted to what Saudi Arabia's demands are. So what's the independent? It doesn't sound like there's a unified view in the U.S. government. It sounds like there's a lot of debate about it. But is that their main objective? Is it just to placate Saudi Arabia, or do we have other?
Oh no, I didn't mean to put it like that, Elliot. What I'm suggesting is that there is one way that these, let's say if you walk into the Brookings Institution, there you will meet somebody who will say there are two modes of thinking in the Arab world. There are the stability people, and then there are the revisionists. And the great revisionist evil is Iran. And so the revisionists have to be prevented, and the revisionists have their allies, Hezbollah. So the revisionists have to be put in their box. And a lot of this discussion is about Israel, actually. The revisionists and then the stability people. And so that thinking is so much there in the State Department, it's nauseating. So if I let's imagine that you are in the State Department and they're having a briefing. So they will say, pillar of stability threatened. Pillar of stability must be upheld. Pillar of stability threatened. Got to reinstate stability in North Africa. Tunisia not yet confirmed Algeria problem. Strengthen Libya. I can imagine. This is how, I don't know if you've ever been to a briefing. They talk vulgarly like, this is our stability. That is our stability. These are people who live there. They have dreams. They want to eat. They want to grow. They want to do things. But their view is, so in other words, it's not just Saudis wagging the, though I said that badly, it's that, also, this is a desired outcome. In other words, this cannot be ruffled. Gates went to Saudi Arabia and said to the king, our alliance is permanent, and your stability is our stability, a.k.a. the Carter Doctrine. The United States will come to the defense of the Gulf. The GCC's formation is actually a child also of the Carter Doctrine. Carter enunciates the doctrine in 80, I think, when he comes in the first year. And within a few months, they start the GCC process. These things are related. So I would say it's this, huh?
78 was the.
Oh, sorry. What am I saying? Yeah. So somewhere, I think it's right after the Iranian Revolution, maybe 80. Reagan comes in 81. So in 80, I think they formulate the doctrine. It's not before the Iranian Revolution. Somewhere in 80. And then 81, the GCC comes. These are together. These are hand in glove, I would say. So I would say that the bad behavior in Egypt with Wisner, and then this very bizarre set of events in Libya, unstable but bizarre, because I'm not saying Khalifa Haftar controls everything, or Jibril controls everything, but this very bizarre set of events that take place indicate an attempt to reinstate stability versus revisionism. I mean, remember, in the middle of all this, even the government of under Tantawi, you know, the great Egyptian general who's a friend, allowed what they called as two Iranian warships to go through Suez and dock in Syria. But one was a freighter and one was an oil supply vessel. But they were warships. When you saw pictures of them, they didn't look as scary as they sounded. Iranian warships have gone. First time since 1979. So that happens at the same time. So this idea of revision versus stability, that seems to me the biggest axis through which this world is observed. It's not seen as human beings with interest. I mean, how I would see it or you would see it. We would see human rights activists in Egypt, you know, in the lead. I would see, you know, this great young 39-year-old lawyer in Benghazi arrested. You know, let him lead Libya. This is not what is seen. What is seen is, where is stability? And they will turn around and tell you it is for your own good, because we are protecting the oil and protecting you against terrorism. And terrorism, a.k.a. Iran. Yeah, Sherry?
I think with all the events that's happened in Libya, I would have loved to see Gaddafi go, because I don't think he's a good man. But now I think he's probably very dangerous, because he's seen all this, and I think that he'll want revenge for these things that have happened. Do you think they will intervene if Gaddafi actually keeps power?
I don't think, like I said, even failed revolutions succeed. This instance, this is not 96, this is not 2002, this is not 1980. I think his base of power is demonstrably much less than it was then. I don't think he's going to be able to come in and clean up Benghazi. You know, Khuza Musa, who defected, in 1980 was the Libyan ambassador to London. And he gave a speech in London saying all stray dogs should be taken care of. And the English asked him to go home. They sent him away. Why? Because what is stray dog? Stray dog means dissidents. Two Libyans were shot in London in 1980. And he was the guy with stray dogs. Okay. So then in 1980, they were able to conduct foreign policy like that. They killed dissidents all over. They, you know, beat up. That game is going to be much harder to run now, because the forward position of that is outside a certain area. I don't think they're going to be able to come in and clean up in Benghazi. It's going to be much more difficult. But which is why I think Libya is now a question of prolonged transition. What is the transition going to look like? The fact that the two sons, Saadi and Saif al-Islam, have made rumored outreach to the English particularly, saying that father is going to go somewhere, but we want to be part of the next dispensation. That might be the deal people will accept. They'll have to accept it. They'll have to accept it because they do have some support in the West. You know, otherwise, what we're going to look forward to is 2004 to 2007 Iraq. In other words, cleansing.
Yeah.
Because Saddam did have support in Iraq. It had to be cleansed. It had to be sent back into the cage. You know, former Ba'ath people, they had to be either killed or moved into Ba'ath areas. So this may be a way, you know, short-term way to move. I don't know. But all I feel is that I don't think it's going to be possible. This is not like a head that you cut and everything is fine. But these people have a support. 80% of the Libyan population lived off oil revenues. So lots of people look up and say, he did great for us. Now, it may not be people on the east.
Yeah.
And it may not be working class people who have grievances. And by the way, they may have grievances if it was somebody less erratic. Because after all, it is a class structure. Mm-hmm. But is it a class structure in normal sense, or is it a diabolical class structure? I mean, we have what I think could be called a diabolical class structure. You know, but people don't, you know, I mean, there are 2 million people in jail or whatever, some huge vulgar numbers, right, high per capita thing. Our class structure is vulgar. We just don't rise up and then get smashed, unless, of course, you picture some people do rise up and they do get smashed. I mean, we don't like them.
One quick question. I'm sorry. Well, I just ask one thing. Moussa Koussa, though, I read, didn't take his family.
No.
Which is strange.
Yeah. Maybe he doesn't like
them. Yeah. May not like them. Let me come and then... It's a new way of doing divorce. I don't know.
I feel like you dropped us in the middle of the story. So
it is. We are in the middle of the story.
We are in the middle of the story. So I want you to go on telling it. What? I mean, here we are. We're still bombing the heck out of Libya. Things are flying. There's people up and down the streets and getting shot all over the east. What's going to happen next? No, you don't have a crystal ball, but you know a lot. Where are things going?
I'm going to help you read the news tomorrow, that's all. I can't tell you what's going
so
to happen.
What's tomorrow's news?
No, I don't mean that. I mean, I don't know, I cannot tell you.
You
I mean, right now...
Is the process under control? Are we going to keep attacking...
No, the United States has withdrawn military operations currently. NATO is now conducting military operations.
NATO
but, of course, the greatest hardware is American hardware in NATO, but still.
Right. What's going to happen in Bahrain? Where are things headed there? And has Syria...
If you have a gallery of dictators, young Assad is like sophisticated dictator exhibit A. He gave a speech 5 days ago where he said, it's like rebel in the name of the Tsar. In other words, the king is good, his officials are bad. Dismiss the cabinet. That's an old trick in the Arab world, the oldest trick. Dismiss the cabinet, dictator remain. But then what does he do? He makes a speech, which I thought was a brilliant speech. One second, I'll come. Brilliant speech.
But don't forget about the...
He makes a speech. He says, firstly, that where the rebellion is happening is Israel's doorway. So he says, conspiracies are afoot. But then he makes the classic, why he becomes sophisticated, he says, every grievance is not a conspiracy. I heard that and I went, wow. Because all of them say, there are conspiracies. You are cockroaches. I will put you down. The real people of my country are, right? I mean, by the cockroaches have to be removed. He said, there are. It's true, he says, that this is Israel's doorway into Syria. There are, everything's not conspiracy. Then today, what does he do? A demand made for 25 years, Kurds get full citizenship. Then he turns to the conservative mullahs. He's governing from a minority sect, but it's a secular regime, so-called. He tells the same people that rose up in 1982 in the Hamar, he says, we are going to give you concessions. He's a sophisticated dictator. So, plus, he now well knows two things about his own population. Let's just assume. One is, Syria took the bulk of Iraqi refugees after 2003. Okay? Syria understands when Israel makes war in Lebanon. Recently, 2006. So Syria has had two major external powers attacking its neighbors. 2003 to the present, and Israel, of course, periodically, but most recently, 2006. The last thing that population needs to be taught about is instability. He has played that card brilliantly. That's why I say sophisticated dictator. He's not a progressive, he's not a reformer, he's not a man of the future, forget all that. But he's a sophisticated dictator. He understands where to move. Gaddafi is an erratic, lunatic dictator. That's the difference between the two. Syria cannot have US intervention. It is much larger in the population centers. Okay? I cannot even understand what a war plan for Syria would look like. Turkey and Iran have already said, we back the regime. Gaddafi was totally isolated immediately. One or two of his friends said, you are still my friend. Berlusconi dithering, because they partied together. But Syria, he played his cards like a champion. Okay, again, don't mistake me. This guy is not a progressive, he's not a reformer, but he is a very sophisticated dictator.
But back to Libya for a minute. NATO's still bombing.
Well, it killed 13 rebels yesterday. So it's not doing a very good job.
What outcome do you see? I mean, how do you see that
I mean, it's a military stalemate. As it is, before the bombing, between, say, Ras Lanuf and Ajdabiya, they were going back and forth like a pendulum. One day the rebels advanced and everybody here got excited. Next day the rebels retreated. Then they advanced, then they got... Then the bombing raid came and Gaddafi's troops moved further up. Past Sirte, they moved up. And then they figured out the bombing and then they moved forward again. There's a military stalemate. There's no breakthrough. In fact, in the transitional council, there are lots of debates breaking out. They just don't know what the political settlement is going to be. And there will be a political settlement. I personally do not think there's going to be a massive ground invasion. None of us mentioned Ivory Coast, Kenya. Yeah. By the way, the great wave can be related to Kenya. Don't you think? I mean, 1990s democratization, the constitution attempt in 2002, then 7-8 election crisis, 2010...
It hasn't gone forward.
But, I mean, there have been different things happening below as well. Al Jazeera ran a terrible story saying this is an Arab thing and Africa below the Sahara is a failed... I mean, it's not true. There's... Ivory Coast is in the middle of a process. But I can't tell you what's going to happen. All I'm saying is there's a military stalemate. People recognize that. And I don't know where you can go forward. One thing I'll say, that Republican from Pennsylvania, I think his name is Kurt Weldon, who is now in Tripoli, wrote a piece in the New York Times 2-3 days ago. He's met Gaddafi. He says, one thing I can tell you, I love the way he said it, Gaddafi cannot be bombed into submission. Similar things were said about Saddam Hussein. He crawled into a hole, remember, and had to be dragged out. These are not people that flee to Saudi Arabia, exile. They have different kinds of personalities. He's not worried. I mean, Al-Saleh is right now negotiating what will happen to my family. What will happen to the security service run by my nephew? You know, they are worried about their treats. This kind of character, they are erratic and crazy. He doesn't care. He, I'm going to die, I'm going to say. His family is insane. Yeah. I'll tell you the stories. Hannibal, Mutasim, they are one crazier than the other. Yeah. Back there, then, Marty.
So it sounds to me that you've been arguing against Western military.
Of course.
But say that we wouldn't have it there. What on earth would have happened? Because you say there would not. This is a Western ploy to reinstitute international humanitarian rants, almost. I don't mean to imply that you're that conspiratorial. But, anyways, the news reports that I was looking at from BBC just prior to the started bombing of Benghazi, and even after the French bombing of Benghazi, when the initial reports after it came out, you could see pictures of tanks outside, lined up, ready to go into Benghazi. So what would have happened if we hadn't intervened? You might say that there wouldn't have been a genocide, but when you saw what happened to the opposition in Tripoli, where you had security forces going from door to door and killing people, I understand the hypocrisy yeah. of American foreign policy, right. But when we have the opportunity to there on what seems to me to be decent grounds,
right.
why not seize on that? There is an opportunity here to create impetus for NATO without the US or the European yeah. Union to there on humanitarian grounds, but the US do not have to be involved.
Right. So there are, I think, two or three things that I can say on that. One is, let's take the narrative again. When the tanks were outside Benghazi, it's not clear that they would have penetrated into Benghazi because they were facing resistance as well. The war had started. The battle of Benghazi had begun. They were not... You must not picture this as Benghazi as Tahrir Square and people singing and dancing inside and the tanks coming in, you know, instead of people on camels. This was not a case of unarmed people sitting in a city waiting. There was a military force. They had confronted each other already, right up the Mediterranean road. They were positioned to attack Benghazi. That is true. But they would have also been repulsed. People in Benghazi had heavy weaponry. The eastern divisions had defected to the side of the rebels. This is not just... You know, the pictures that you see, okay? You can, if you want, John Simpson in BBC has done a very good report on this. From Tripoli side. pictures you see, he says, of people going back and forth, the people carrying a gun, walking, smiling, they're not going to the front. The front is held by military, the military that defected. What you're seeing is you're seeing people strolling like it's a picnic. Getting on, there was a picture, in fact, I wrote a story for a magazine, came yesterday. They put a picture there of a guy had put a carbine on top of a truck and held it up with shoes. But they're not going to the front, you know, necessarily. They're not all going to the front. Some are going and coming back. But there are troops that are involved in this engagement. That is, the troops that defected. So there is a line. That's how they are able to hold the line. You know, Gaddafi is bringing his hardened troops out. How could they have not swept them if they were just human rights activists who picked up the gun yesterday? So these are real troops. So let's not picture it as defenseless people being attacked. Okay, that's the first thing I would say. Second thing I would say is there were two options that were on the table. One option was others were going to go and talk immediately. Okay, the option that I would say nobody took seriously was an option to create a corridor from Egypt to Benghazi. There's an open road. War refugees could have been removed. If it's truly humanitarian, why do we always go to aerial bombardment and not creating a safe corridor to remove war refugees? Because it was a war in Benghazi. It was not defenseless people being attacked. You know, today the NATO commander said Gaddafi's troops are hiding among civilians. But so were the rebels inside Benghazi. That's the nature of this kind of war. I'm not defending hiding with civilians. I'm just saying that's an issue. If it's a good humanitarian response, remove civilians from the city. Let them get the option to leave. Civilians had moved up the road from Brega, Ashtabia to Benghazi. Open a corridor into Egypt. Why did the Egyptian military not get involved? Why is that question not there? I'm not saying involved in attacking Gaddafi, because they would not have done that. But they could have opened a corridor. The Tunisians opened a corridor. They allowed people to cross the border. Right? Then Tunisia faced immediately humanitarian crisis. So UN ships had to come. Turkish ships still going back and forth. Not the one going to Misrata, but Turkish ships going to Tunisia. So that would have been possible. So those are the two. Third thing I would say is, yes, going door to door, killing people. Fine. Every revolution in the Gulf has faced that. Today, I was following BBC in Cote d'Ivoire, in Abidjan, the rebels are going door to door and pulling out Gbagbo's people. It is going to be a bloodbath in Abidjan. And the French bombed Abidjan already, right, 2 days ago. But they bombed Gbagbo's ammunition dumps so that Ouattara's troops could enter. Ouattara's troops coming in and they're going door to door. So this door to door thing, I agree, is despicable. But this is not going to be stopped by aerial bombardment. I'm just talking strategy now with you. I don't want to get like who is morally, you know, like I want to save everybody in the world. This is not possible. I'm talking strategically. I agree. Going door to door and killing people is unacceptable. But how is aerial bombardment going to prevent it? Particularly when the bombardment begins, Zintan, Misrata, clamp down. Tripoli, working class districts, totally quiet. Now, you can't say that they're quiet because of repression alone. The propaganda is fierce. What are they saying? The colonial occupation has begun anew. These people are patriots as much as they are anti-Gaddafi. Just as in Iraq, when the Americans entered, people who may not necessarily have been anti-American, like the Sadrites, for instance, who had paid in blood much more than anybody else under Saddam. In fact, Muqtada's own father, and you know, they had paid in blood. But what did they do? Their patriotism was fierce. They came out and fought the American troops. So the intervention actually, I would say, has the opposite effect of helping along the rebellion. Because it will quiet elements that would have may have supported the Benghazi people. When you start having pictures of people in from Benghazi with French flags on Libyan tanks inside working class areas, opposite reaction will happen. Because people are also patriotic. So what I would say is, I agree with you. It was a point of incredible confusion. You got all the reports, it was terrifying. But I'm telling you, the thing you have to cultivate is sober thinking. My friend Juan Cole lost his head. Gilbert, who I love, lost his head.
Why don't we have to be full?
Two more questions. Yes.
Well, I agree that, that we shouldn't just go on bomb, because war is the last solution for monkeys. That's how everything. But taking people out, and this is not a small town, right?
No.
So it's a lot of people, so that will take a long time, and then what happens to the houses of the people? Like, how would you bring them back? And what if Gaddafi didn't, like, give up, you know? So, like, other options I was thinking of is negotiations with Enafke. I know this is not, it's probably not something that anybody has thought of, like, because he's crazy, nobody can talk to him, whatever. But could we consider negotiations? And what about the peacekeeping process?
Well, let's take the peacekeeping because it's easy. The African Union is a toothless organization. It has been underfunded. It has not been able to work effectively where it's been placed, in Chad, in Darfur, in Ivory Coast. It doesn't have a great record. The African Union is underfunded. Plus, worse than that, Gaddafi was the great benefactor of the African Union. In fact, is it in Lusaka that he built a mansion for every head of state of an African country when they have an African summit? They each have a house, big house, fancy house. I mean, he's spread Libyan oil money around the African Union. So the African Union had a certain problem. Nonetheless, they were sending a negotiating team because they understood the ramifications. But March 19th resolution circumvented the team. In fact, they were not allowed to fly into Tripoli. They still wanted to go March 20th, but they were told you cannot leave. So-called member states of the UN that were conducting the operations. Because that's how the UN resolution is phrased. Member states can use all necessary measures.
Yeah.
So there was, not peacekeepers, but there was negotiation. You know, nobody is crazy, that crazy that you can't talk to them. Okay, so, and there are people, like I would have, what I would have done, I would have said, Berlusconi, please just go there. Okay, you are equally crazy, lunatic guy. Why is he any less crazy than Gaddafi? They are great pals. If you want to know about the great palliness, go on YouTube, watch the G8 luncheons. They'll be hugging and walking and drunk and looking at it. They are grotesque. Look, I would have said, these are your close. You know, one thing, people like me, Marxist type thinkers, we underestimate the power of personal friendship in international relations. So you have to actually understand these play a role. That's why Obama sent his emissary to talk to another lunatic. Why was Mubarak any less crazy? Mubarak ran the most brutal security service. Right? Under Mubarak's security service, Umar Suleiman, his head of internal security, in fact, was, it is said, in Libya, when one of the so-called Al-Qaeda people was brought back. And the story is told that Umar Suleiman was involved in the torture. Slapped the guy and the guy's mask fell and he saw Umar Suleiman. He was considered by the Americans as a good replacement for Mubarak after Tahrir Square, Umar Suleiman, right? He gets made the vice president. He was physically involved in a torture in Libya. If we can send Wisner to talk to Mubarak, Gaddafi, who was on his knees to be friendly with the West, they had sent somebody. You want a humanitarian mission? Send Obama. He would have charmed the socks off him. Gaddafi would have said, take the whole East. He loves Obama. He just wrote a letter to Obama saying, thank you for removing your planes. You have left the Crusader mission. He's a crazy. But he would have. So why not? Why bomb before Obama? Send the Nobel Prize winner. But these things were not even on the table. And it's not a conspiracy. But I don't mind the conspiracy. This is not a conspiracy. It's a series of events. It's a process. No, there's no conspiracy here. It's a series of events. When I suggest that a guy who lived in Vienna goes there, it's not a conspiracy. It's a convenient thing that the Americans had somebody, an asset in hand, who was respected by the military enough because he was a war hero in Chad, that they parachuted him in. That's a convenience. It's always good to have reliable assets in hand.
Your description of the change in the resistance in Libya brings to mind things that happened in the 1970s among the Mujahideen against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan and the CIA's manipulation of the legitimate resistance in Afghanistan. That's number one. And I wonder if this does stalemate, if it is not settled, if that is what is to become in Libya, what you think about that. Second, and you may not want to take this on because it's just too big, Yemen.
Yeah, let's leave Yemen up. The Libya thing is not comparable to Afghanistan. One reason is Europe is too close. There will be too many refugees going to Italy. And it would be such a long-term bleeding that I don't think the EU would welcome. The Maltese certainly would not welcome, and Egypt is not going to play the role of Pakistan. You know, Egypt is definitely not going to be, you know, or play the role of Honduras, if you want to extend the model. You know, nor is Tunisia, nor will Algeria, nor will Chad, certainly, play the role of Honduras, you know, or Pakistan. So, I mean, I don't think it's that kind of model. Secondly, I actually don't think the rebels in eastern Libya are identical to the Mujahideen. Mujahideen were worse. I mean, the United States allied in Afghanistan with two of the most repellent characters in modern Afghan politics. One was Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a horrible guy, and the other was Ahmad Shah Massoud, who for some reason has become like a Che Guevara figure. But, you know, in his youth, the two of them in Kabul University were vicious, vicious, misogynistic, hateful fellows. So the Americans decided they were better than the communists. You know, the communist agenda in the 1970s looks good to me. You know, they allowed divorce by decree. By decree did land reforms. I mean, they may have been crazy in their strategy, like they had no base outside the major cities and the military. They may have been crazy, but I don't think they were bad. But the United States there decided to go with the most horrible elements and build them up. But so I don't think these rebels are quite like that. I think there is a lot of that human rights kind of crowd that are there, these entrepreneurial suave, European-educated people in Benghazi. I don't think these are quite throwing acid in the face of young girls in the engineering department. These are not those guys.
What do you think about Chavez's pronouncements in relationship to Latvia? I mean, talking about friends and, you know, that. Do you find that significant or maybe not?
Right. I mean, that's why I said that thing about friendship. I was thinking about Chavez very much in that. There is a problem in the way they made their critiques. I cannot understand why they would consider Gaddafi to be part of their side of history. Gaddafi, A, since 69, lost the political discussion. As I said, he centralized power in the name of decentralization. He didn't even have a democratic agenda. Today, any person on the left has to have a democratic agenda. You know, that's the great lesson we learned from the Soviet Union. That if you don't have a democratic agenda, you are not a person of the future. So that's the first thing. And you know, Chavez has, I think, learned that lesson. That he attempted a coup that failed, and then he's been elected, what, 10 times? Whatever, some god-awful number of times. They keep having elections. Now, people will say it's a rigged election. Our elections are rigged. I mean, what does rigged mean? That's a stupid thing. They believe in democracy, you know. Gaddafi does not believe in democracy, so he's on the wrong side of history. I mean, secondly, the way he has doled out oil revenues, they are not to build up the capacity of the Libyan people. They are simply transfer payments to buy loyalty. Transfer payments to buy loyalty is not socialism. Socialism, you have to build the capacity of the people. And if you travel to Venezuela, people are exploring all kinds of new ways of building the means of existence. So that way, in terms of program, there should have been nothing that united them. But this is the problem with friendship. And they are friends. And Ahmadinejad is a friend. And we need to theorize IR plus friendship. And people in IR don't consider friendship. And I think that's a big problem.
I know you had your hand up.
Yes, please. Yeah.
I think this is the first time when the United Nations has essentially gotten involved militarily into a sovereign state. Essentially taken the fact aside from civil war. Essentially, since this is an act of war, U.S. guns, or I think they're using plutonium weapons.
That's the best way to do humanitarian intervention.
Yeah.
Yeah. Use uranium. But this is not the first time. There is, of course, Iraq.
Korea. Which with Iraq and Kuwait.
No, no, resolution in 2003. March 2003 resolution.
No, no, but the UN didn't sanction it.
You sanctioned
it? Yeah. Remember, Colin Powell goes there.
February.
Yeah.
What was the resolution number? I don't remember.
Yeah.
He
and
goes,
Korea.
Remember, he goes and he does his thing with the mobile units that Al-Libi gave that so-called intelligence.
To remove Iraq from Kuwait.
So that was August 1990. Resolution came there or November 1990. This is in 2003. Yeah, remember he came, Colin Powell. Wasn't there a resolution?
Yeah, it was.
The UN, the Security Council, passed one for...
They didn't pass a resolution. There was a UN...
There was one about the weapons. Yeah, weapons inspections and so on, which could be read as...
That's right, but that's enough.
But that was much more ambiguous.
But even this actually doesn't say, listen, here's the funny thing. This resolution, 1973, simply says establish a no-fly zone.
Yeah.
The French bomb.
Yeah.
What is Amr Moussa's first reaction, head of the Arab League?
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know you were going to bomb. We thought you were just going to establish a no-fly zone. Remember that?
Yeah.
And then Ban Ki-moon says, naughty boy, come here. And they have a joint press conference in Cairo. Standing next to Ban Ki-moon, Amr Moussa says, actually, we support this 100%. So, no resolution actually says we authorize you to go to war.
Yeah.
I agree with you. That nobody has said we authorize you to... But 1970 was so badly written.
Yeah.
I also agree that it's the first resolution which I've read which has made me deeply uneasy. Behind the UN Security Council, there's a great mural made by, a Norwegian or Finnish artist. Okay, it's a white supremacist mural because in the middle there's a white family with a child and sort of they're looking out. It's like some weird thing. Below, there is it's very orientalist. There is somebody with a turban, and they're all like this, and then there's like this, and then there's a cannon, a howitzer cannon pointing at these brown people all shriveled up. And I thought that is the perfect metaphor for 1973. You know, it's what Gayatri Spivak says, white man saves brown woman from brown man. You know, in this case, that was Afghanistan, actually. This case is sort of white man saves brown man from brown man. You know, the war happening here, miserable, and this white supremacist family saying, we will take, and there's somebody reaching a hand down to pull them up. It's a grotesque mural. It's right there in the Security Council deliberation room. Okay, right behind them. So this resolution I thought stank. It's the worst that I've read.
Hired by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shiny black
This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive, which is unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's also a mailing list for any discussion of the show at altruists.org/unwelcome. And we have a Twitter feed announcing new episodes at twitter.com/unwelcomeguests. The music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving balls.